The next matter on for oral argument this morning is State of Minnesota versus Yusoff. Counsel, as you're arranging yourselves, I will just remind you of our rules. Each side will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional five for the appellant's counsel for rebuttal, if you choose to use that time. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument and be mindful of the timing restrictions, which are indicated in the podium, the light, and the clock. Should let you know how much time you have remaining. And by the way, you can elevate if you need to. Both of you, I think, are taller than our previous attorneys. There's a button right in front that allows you to elevate or lower the podium to your convenience. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Adam Klinert, attorney for appellant Abdulaziz Yusoff. This case is about Mr. Yusoff being denied a fair trial. Effective confrontation and cross-examination is the cornerstone of our legal system. The case law is clear that evidence of bias and racial prejudice of any kind is extremely important for the jury to know, especially in cases where the credibility of the witness is the key evidence and the motivation of the witness is the key evidence in the case. This case is one that, like many cases, rests substantially on the testimony of eyewitnesses, three eyewitnesses that had been friends for a long time and were quite close. I do want to address the respondent's argument that I think it's a distraction to discuss it's kind of a side argument about Muslim faith separate from Somali, that I think that is a little bit of a distraction because it is clear that the Facebook post had a distaste for Somalis and Somali Muslims. I don't think that the operative issue was just Muslim and what these posts were alleged to have shown. I believe it's common knowledge that the overwhelming majority of people from Somalia are Muslim. I know the U.S. Supreme Court, when looking at the, I guess it was called the travel ban or the Muslim ban, identified that as a concern. Looking at different countries in the Middle East, I don't think that the defendant had some necessity to prove that he was Muslim. There, it would almost sound like a religious test. I mean, his middle name is Muhammad. I don't think that detracts from the appellant's argument in this case.
Counsel, I have a question for you. My reading of the record and the briefs indicates that you, the prosecutor, and the district court were of the belief that the mid-trial disclosure of the existence of the Facebook posts was some sort of discovery violation under Minnesota law. Do you agree that that was a discovery violation?
I don't believe that it was unusual, but I wouldn't characterize it as a violation because I don't believe there was any bad faith or...
Well, let me ask this, because this is the question I'm struggling with in this case. What rule, and I think we could all agree, Minnesota Rule Criminal Procedure 9.02 governs defendants' disclosure obligations in a felony case without court order. What portion of that rule mandated that you had to disclose these Facebook posts at all? I mean, there seems to be this underlying presumption by the district court and the parties that you had an obligation to disclose these Facebook posts to the state, and I'm wondering why.
I see. I just want to clarify, I wasn't the attorney at the district court level, but the appellant in general speaking. about him. I guess if it's if it is going to be impeachment evidence or something like that, I don't believe that he would have an obligation to disclose it, that he could bring it up. That gets right to another one of my points, actually, if I may, or if you had a further question.
So your answer is, if it's impeachment evidence, it need not be disclosed?
Correct.
Okay.
But I don't know that it is necessarily characterized as that when it's going to evidence of bias or prejudice.
Well, isn't the purpose of the rule regarding extrinsic evidence of bias, I mean, isn't that a form of impeachment? This evidence is being offered to convince the finder of fact that the witness is not credible. Isn't that sort of the heart of impeachment?
Yes, that is true. I was thinking impeachment for credibility rather than impeachment for prejudice or bias when I was answering that earlier.
The credibility issues only go to... I don't understand the distinction you're making between credibility, and then on the one hand, and bias and prejudice on the other. Aren't they one and the same?
I don't believe so. So,
what would be the relevance of a credibility challenge other than impeachment?
It would be impeachment to their propensity to tell the truth, where I believe that prejudice and bias can affect your initial interpretation of the situation, not necessarily whether you are someone who tells the truth or not.
But it all goes to the believability of the testimony.
In a big umbrella, yes.
Okay.
Going to that, about impeachment, I don't think that the timing of this prejudices the state in a huge way and doesn't prejudice the defense. I think the best time for the defense to have brought this up would have been before trial and trying to resolve the case short of trial. Is something that they could have shown that they were going to use. It could have avoided a trial entirely. The second best time for the defense to have brought this up was on the original cross-examination. To impeach them with it. That would have been their time to shine and really to get them.
On that note, the district court said two things based on the timing and the irrelevance of the evidence. Going back to the timing, we can look at the timing in terms of, was there an obligation to disclose this in the first place? And if so, was it untimely such that there was a discovery violation, which kind of takes us under Lindsay factors. Another way to look at this, perhaps, would be to say, well, the district court has the authority to control the mode and presentation of evidence, and maybe the district court was just saying, you should have found this out sooner. I'm not going to delay my trial by having you call a witness back to the stand. This could have happened earlier, sort of separately from whether or not it was a disclosure violation in the first place. Can you address whether the district court would have been within its discretion to prohibit additional cross-examination of this witness simply as a means of controlling the mode and order of presentation of evidence?
The district court would have been within their discretion to not allow that witness to be called again. The defense, if it was on his witness list listed that he could call any of the state's witnesses, should certainly be allowed to call him in his case in chief. The court did allow that witness to be...
Can the defense call him solely for impeachment purposes? This case is like a law school exam, so I don't want to put you on the spot, but... All right, so what you're saying is like, okay, maybe in theory the district court could have said, we're not bringing this witness back. You should have taken care of this yesterday. But in fact, is that what the district court said?
No, I think that's a moot point because the district court allowed that witness to be recalled and questioned about his racial prejudice or bias. But the concerning part to me is that the district court did not allow extrinsic evidence of that Facebook post. And that, to me, defeats the purpose of spending all the time to recall the witness as I outlined in my brief to...
Is it fair to say, I mean, as I read the district court's order, it was like, you think extrinsic evidence sort of like, I read the district court's order to mean you can't ask him about these Facebook posts at all, as opposed to you ask him, he denies it, you show him a copy and say, well, now that you've seen this, does your answer remain, there's no Facebook post? So is that your understanding of the district court's order, that defense counsel could not even ask about the existence of the posts?
Correct. That was my understanding, that it would be extrinsic evidence of a particular incident, and he couldn't go down that road. The appellant's attorney couldn't go down that road at all.
Just because it was untimely and irrelevant.
Correct. That's what the district court argued. I outlined why I think that it was extremely relevant in this case.
Well, as to relevance, the state makes sort of three arguments. One, it's not relevant. Two, it's a disclosure violation. And three, even if the district court erred, it was harmless because there was, you know, substantial evidence of guilt beyond the testimony. Was it JM who did the posts? Could you address that argument? I mean, I'm asking, well, let's say the full impeachment value of the Facebook post was realized at trial. No juror was going to believe what JM had to say. Given the rest of the record, is it likely that the jury would have acquitted?
I think that there's a reasonable possibility the jury could have acquitted in this case because it was just the testimony of those witnesses that was...
Okay, but we don't have any sort of racial posts from the other two people in the car. Nor, importantly, the person who got out of the car, I think, see him? Got out of the car, walked up to the sedan, had the gun pointed right at him, described that for the police, described the gun. He identifies him at trial, I assume, your client. And the police find a gun that matches the description. A statement comes in from your client which explains his actions, which is sort of illogical and might have caused the jury to question the statement to the police. Isn't that enough to sustain this conviction? Not merely enough, but isn't that strong evidence of guilt that would have allowed the state to prevail even if JM was thoroughly cross-examined about the Facebook posts?
I don't believe so, because I believe the argument from the defense would have been how connected and long-term these friends were, that... I know the courts in criminal cases have looked at kind of those friend groups, co-ventures. If they're doing, some one of them is doing something illegal, the court kind of applies that everyone must have had that same kind of motive, whether it's something like drugs or, and I certainly know my friends aren't making posts about pro-Hitler posts and about not liking all the Somali Muslims here. You keep the company that is similar to you. And I think that the jury reasonably could have concluded that those strong, kind of unusual feelings from one person of this close group of friends that have been friends since high school is likely shared by the others, or they could have at least been asked about it as well if it was established from JM.
Do you find, is there case support for that? The idea that you sort of sweep in all of the witnesses who testify in favor of, in the state's behalf, if there is one of them, as far as the harmless error analysis goes, that you can essentially discredit all of the witnesses or assume the discrediting of all the witnesses in a harmless error analysis based upon their relationship without any evidence of their expressing similar views.
The most analogous case law, I can't recall the name of the case, but it involves probable cause for police to search or detain people traveling in a car together. It's a similar type situation to what we had in this case, that the courts have held that there can at least be that probable cause presumption that could be dispelled. That's what the...
probable cause of what? I'm not understanding the circumstances of the hypothetical you're getting.
That case was about, it was about some sort of drug possession, or it was a drug case where the court held that the police knew something about one of the people in the car doing that and that he was involved in drug activity at that point in time, and they said it was reasonable to apply it to everyone in the vehicle. I want to say it's like, I can get the site for the court, but it's something like Berrios or something like that is the defendant's last name. But also, I don't think that the standard is that the jury would have to assume everyone is like that, that it's definitely not unreasonable for the jury to conclude that there's a reasonable possibility that the jury could conclude that.
But the reason you're giving is just the fact that they have a friendship.
Correct. And I think a little bit of this didn't play out because if the appellant's attorney would have been allowed to question JM about it, we might have got some more information. I think that those posts, if they were made by him, as alleged, we kind of didn't get to figure that out. It might have led to a lot more information that it's kind of the jury is that finder of fact and assessor of credibility, that it's really their job to determine how much weight to give that, and they reasonably could have given it enough weight to acquit in this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the state.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel.
Good morning. My name
is Kyle Triggs. I represent the respondent, the state of Minnesota. We are asking you to affirm Mr. Youssef's conviction for two general overarching reasons. Number one, the right to present a complete defense, as important as it is not a license to simply dig up evidence in the dead middle of trial and surprise the state with it, especially...
Why not? Isn't that what impeachment's all about?
It is not when they were talking about evidence in this case that is far more unfairly prejudicial than probative, Your Honor.
Prejudicial to whom?
It would be prejudicial to the state.
To introduce evidence of bias in the middle of a trial would be prejudicial to? Is it unfairly prejudicial?
In the manner it was done here, Your Honor, yes, because
Why?
Of the material. So I'll talk about each post. The Hitler post is the most obvious one. We have a vague description of him defending.
I'm not talking about the substance. I'm talking about as a matter of procedure. Why would it be unfair to challenge a state's witness, even if it's a surprise, complete surprise to the state, that the defendant is challenging the witness? Is there a rule or a constitutional provision that protects the state from impeachment of its witnesses without notice?
If all we're talking about is confronting the witness about a prior inconsistent statement or the mere act of impeaching, I'm not aware that a defense has to say, hey, in advance, I'm letting you know I'm going to impeach them because, of course,
Does the defense have to do it in this case?
Well, here we're talking about evidence of the pulse. Just to be clear, Your Honor's asking about evidence, introducing the post in order.
Oh, the post. I thought you said impulse. Okay, I didn't understand
for impeachment purposes. What rule or law says that the defendant has to disclose to the state before trial the substance of documents or information that it might use to impeach the state's witnesses? Because that's what you seem to be arguing. We should have been told about this before trial.
Correct.
But what rule or law requires that disclosure?
Your Honor, and I apologize for not putting this in my brief. I'm looking at Rule 902, Subdivision 1D. All documents the defendant intends to introduce. And that was under, I believe it's in the appellate record, under document ID number 6, we filed a demand for disclosure.
So you're saying the Facebook post is a document?
If it used it as evidence, it would presumably be in the form of a document. I mean, that's how, if it comes in the form of evidence, it would have to be printed out and used.
But for cross-examination purposes, why can't the witness simply be asked, did you, in fact, post the following on Facebook?
And Your Honor's talking about without ever using it and just asking about it verbally.
Right.
And at that.
That's not prohibited by the rule, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I believe this is where 403 kicks in. And the reason it kicks in is because the content of this post, we have a balancing test. In this particular case, it's not necessarily all the time, but in this particular case, this is sensitive material.
Sensitive,
the reference to supporting Hitler.
Why is that sensitive?
Well, it certainly can inflame the jury. It's deeply from many people.
Inflame the jury by?
The notion that a witness supported Hitler in some fashion without knowing the context. The problem is, if we don't know about that in advance of the trial, we have a pool of jurors who may react differently to that post. And some, depending
on... How might they react in a way that prejudices the state?
It would prejudice the state in that if there's a witness, let's say, who hears about it and feels deeply offended that someone once defended Hitler without knowing the context or the details, which the defense did not provide, if they hear that and they react so strongly in saying...
Why would the defense, by the way, need to provide it? Wouldn't the witness have an opportunity to provide the context, or the state have the opportunity on rehabilitation to provide context of that would satisfy any of this prejudice you're talking about?
The witness could certainly, if the witness really didn't make that comment, they would presumably be prepared to discuss it. And what I'm getting at, Your Honor, is if the state knows that certain topics are going to come up that are potentially sensitive, inflammatory, a prior instance of bad conduct, not something that involves not just an inconsistent statement, but a statement that's offensive. The state should have the right to make sure that none of the jurors will close their minds to the rest of the evidence after being so offended by the reference to Hitler.
I understand the argument. What case, anywhere, supports that proposition?
Your Honor, I would more rely on Rule 403, which covers all evidence. I don't have a case on
hand. As to 403, we have more prejudicial than probative. That's an inquiry under 403. And then we have all the case law and rule that deals with impeachment by evidence of bias. And, you know, the rule is clear. Bias evidence is admissible both for impeachment and extrinsic evidence. We have a rule that says bias evidence comes in. Mm-hmm. We've got case law from the U.S. Supreme Court, from this court, from the Minnesota Supreme Court that says evidence of bias comes in, it's almost always relevant. What you seem to be arguing is, well, if your bias evidence is evidence of racial bias, that generally angers and upsets people, so that's never going to come in.
And I'm sorry, I probably misspoke. That's not what I intended to say. If I
Are you
clarify.
Just saying that evidence about allegiance to Hitler never comes in because that's so understandably upsetting to people? I mean, it seems to me that you're sort of requesting us to make, you know, a broad exception to law that says bias evidence comes in, period. And I mean, I understand that there could be circumstances where you're going too far or presenting too much and you're tipping the balance, but what you seem to be saying is this type of bias evidence should never be allowed.
You know, I apologize if my arguments came across that way. I misspoke. I'll try to start over if that's okay. We're looking at, first and foremost, the probative value. Our argument, first and foremost, before we even get into prejudice, is that the defense didn't adequately substantiate the probative value. They made a vague reference to Facebook posts. They did not provide the details of the Facebook posts.
But it seems to me from reviewing the record, the defense said, here's what the posts show. And the state and the district court sort of took the defense counsel at his word and analyzed the circumstances based on the representations that defense counsel made. Yes, it would have been better to have had a copy of the post proffered as support for the request to admit, assuming there was an obligation to disclose that in the first place. But, I mean, if everybody in the courtroom sort of accepted the defense's representations regarding what the post said, isn't that an adequate record for us to say, okay, given those representations, would this cross-examination have been more prejudicial than probative? In other words, I'm feeling like we can review this even though we don't have a copy of the post because everybody seems to have accepted the defense's representation of what those posts showed.
Well, again, when we're talking about their representations, we take their words at face value. Their words at face value never said bias towards all Somali individuals.
At okay, no but they said Somali Muslim individuals.
A specific group.
Okay,
yes,
and did you dispute that appellant is a Somali American?
He's certainly a Somali American.
So isn't there enough overlap between the post and the appellant to make an argument that this was potentially relevant bias evidence?
I don't think we can get there because at that point, as counsel argued, well, we can infer he's probably Muslim, but then at this point we're marching into...
What if he's not Muslim? Does it matter? If the posts are against Somali Muslims and he's Somali but not Muslim, are you saying that doesn't show he's biased?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm going to move back because I think the important part of this case for me is this notion that there was at any point any obligation on the defense to disclose these posts, which I assume were as available to the state as they were to the defendant before trial. So your position is that the failure to make a pretrial disclosure of the existence of these posts was a violation of 902(1)(1) because the Facebook page constitutes a document.
If it were used at trial, yes, Your Honor.
But here, according to the record, we don't even have a document being presented to the court. So it seems sort of odd to me to say, well, that was a document that should have been disclosed if the defense never even came to court with a document in the first place and just said, I want to ask about these posts.
And Your Honor is asking that, is Your Honor asking, does the fact that you're doing it merely for impeachment as opposed to using it as extrinsic evidence?
Yes.
Your Honor.
We don't have any case law in Minnesota, as best I can tell, that addresses discovery obligations related to impeachment evidence. My review of the federal case law is that all of the circuits agree evidence that's going to be used for impeachment purposes, even extrinsic evidence for impeachment purposes, need not be disclosed, as opposed to evidence that's going to be offered as part of the defendant's case in chief. So, for example, if this defendant had wanted to present these Facebook posts or this document in support of a self-defense claim, then that perhaps would be subject to the disclosure obligations. But I'm not understanding how the defendant's intent to impeach based on those Facebook posts, even if the defense would have liked to have printed them off and used them as extrinsic evidence, falls within the disclosure obligations of Rule 902.
Well, Your Honor, the reason why I believe they would is because you could say that bias evidence is a form of impeachment evidence, but if you look at the comments under the rule, the bias rule under the rules of evidence, that more turns to relevance, evidence that's relevant to the trial and the believability of the witnesses. When we're talking about merely about impeachment, about confronting a witness at trial about something that a prior statement that goes against their current testimony or things of that nature, that is different than offering substantive evidence so that you can then say to the jury, ladies and gentlemen, this witness has a motive to frame my client, or this witness has a motive not to tell the truth. Here's the evidence showing.
Why? I don't understand why there's this fundamental difference. It strikes me as strange. Usually we're having this discussion, and it's the state that is arguing that it was perfectly fine to surprise the defendant with this evidence. The witness, it's impeachment. So, I'm at a loss to how the rules cover the a non-document at all. I mean, I'm sort of stuck on the point that Judge Larkin is referring to. But I'm also troubled by the idea that you're saying that if something is so prejudicial, it can't be admitted for impeachment when it is its probative nature. When you're balancing prejudice versus probative, the probative nature of impeachment evidence is its impeachment quality. In other words, it's designed to be prejudicial. So I'm not sure how the balancing works in the context of impeachment evidence, but I've thrown a few issues at once. It's hard to say you're swinging at a softball or a fastball when there's five or six balls coming at you. Swing away.
It is the point of this oral argument. I do want to address your questions, Your Honor, and I want to capture this one before I address Your Honor's question so I don't forget. At the end of the day, even if this court found the decision to be improper, what we are talking about is a witness whose credibility did not it was not the kind of credibility that our verdict hung in the balance over. It was one of three witnesses who witnessed the incident. The other two had no history of bias, had no evidence of bias in the record. In fact, one of those witnesses testified that he told J.M. that he saw the gun. So this was not two witnesses relying on J.M.'s perspective. They all simultaneously saw it by themselves. So whatever, if the court were to find that something went wrong here, there's no basis for reversal anyways.
Can you address the prejudice by association argument?
Certainly, certainly. Your Honor, when we're talking about making sure the jury focuses on credibility, because that's the only permissible purpose. You can't obviously use evidence to say, hey, this person has bad character. The goal should be to make sure a jury will properly weigh the credibility. With respect to the Hitler comment, now certainly if that is probative of a motive to lie and a juror were to weigh that accordingly, then that's ordinarily permissible. The issue here is that in any trial, if we know that a particularly sensitive or triggering issue may be brought to the jury, whether it's references to Hitler or things of that nature, there's a risk it could cause a jury, or at least some of the jurors, to be so offended that they will look at it in terms of character evidence, depending on how personally they take it or depending how much it bothers them. And when sensitive issues like those are coming in, both parties should have the opportunity during voir dire to ask the jury, you may hear about certain issues, you may hear about certain topics. Is there any of you who may be so bothered that you'll have difficulties looking at the rest of the evidence? With that kind of issue, such as in this case, that's all the more reason why the state was at a disadvantage for not knowing about it.
I thought you were going to address the guilt bias. I think the argument that, maybe I wasn't clear enough with my question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The argument's been made that when it comes to harmless error, the error was not harmless in this case because the other witnesses who testified in favor of the state would be tainted by the bias ascribed to the witness who made the post. And your time has expired, but if you can answer in a sentence, unless there may be other questions by the panel as well.
Thanks for the mulligan. I appreciate it. Yes. What is shown is they are friends. You can be friends with someone who has different views on political issues, cultural issues. He's citing modern, current examples. The late Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg were best friends, and they had completely opposite views on political and legal issues. By analogy, I know in the details of U.S. v. Abel, the cornerstone case they cite about bias, the interesting there is in that one, the bias in question had to do with someone's affiliation with a group, an affiliation with the Aryan Brotherhood, which had a mission statement to lie and cheat and do whatever it takes to help one another out. And they said, well, yeah, if you're a part of that group, that's evidence of bias. But that's different than simply being friends with somebody. Association with a group means association with its mission. Being friends with someone can be based on any number of things, and we don't have anything beyond that here. There was no evidence suggesting that JM's two friends were subscribing to every one of his views. And for that reason, there's no harmless error.
Thank you. Unless there are any other questions.
Or no harmful error.
Panel?
Sorry.
Thank you. Your Honor. Thank you. Counsel for Appellant.
Adam Klinert, counsel for appellant, Abdulaziz Yusuf. May it please the court. I think that the biggest takeaway from the respondent's argument is how prejudicial to the state having the jury know this information about the witness really is, and that's what it really comes down to, the state knows that this could have influenced the jury. That's why they go on about how bad it would be for the jury to know this. I don't think that you could ever pick a jury that is going to be okay with someone who supports Hitler. I don't think the timing of this makes a big difference. The reason it's so prejudicial is because of what it is in itself, and that's why it's so important for Mr. Yusuf to be able to bring this up. I don't think that Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia would be his close friends if Justice Scalia was saying that he supports Hitler and has a dislike for Somali Muslims in America. That's such an extreme, it's a different type of thing than a different political view. It is quite honestly racist, and it's bias. It's an extreme representation by an adult on Facebook that is so out of the ordinary that it's something that needs to be heard by the jury. Talking about the jury kind of inferring that those feelings must have been felt by everyone in the car, I don't think that that's a necessary...
What would be the rule of law? I'm trying to understand how we would craft the standard by which we would distinguish the hypothetical or actual Scalia-Ginsburg friendship from a friendship between a group of individuals, one of whom is a racist or one of whom who has extreme political views. What would be the rule of law that would allow, on the one hand, a finding of harmless error and not on the other?
I don't know that I could articulate a bright line rule, but I'd argue that the analysis is that it reasonably could have led to an acquittal. And the court should, part of the analysis should be that these are all very close friends, roommates, traveling in the same car. If one of the other witnesses was a third party that had nothing to do with these people that saw the exact same thing, that would obviously be on the other side of, would this be any different? I don't know that there can be a bright line rule about this. I just think that there isn't truly independent, substantial other evidence other than these three associates. I just want to also say that the most concerning part for the appellant is not the support of Hitler, as it is the dislike for Somali Americans and our Somali Muslims in America. That is such a small group of people. That is exactly who he is. This person has expressed dislike on a public forum about his dislike for the exact type of person that the defendant is in this case. It isn't just a general trying to smear the witness. The witness has said they don't like Somali Muslims in America, exactly who the defendant is. I think that that is what makes this, just as a public policy consideration, when one of the state's main witnesses has said that they don't like exactly the type of person that the defendant is, and the jury doesn't get to hear that, that's where I think the problem is and what you need to think about in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. Thank you for your briefing, for your oral argument today. The matter is submitted, and we'll issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you very much.